Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and SiriusXM Channel 141. This is the Inside segment. I'm Harold Fisher. No-knock warrants will soon be a thing of the past in Virginia. Yesterday, Governor Ralph Northam signed what's being called Breonna's Law, named after Breonna Taylor, who was shot to death by police in Louisville, Kentucky back in March during a no-knock warrant raid. The General Assembly passed the bill during a special session, and Virginia becomes only the third state to make these new rules. This is only part of sweeping police reforms passed during the special session in the Commonwealth. And we're looking at what it all means tonight. My guest is Virginia State Delegate Latrice Aird. And you, the listener, lines are open. Give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Tweet me at HFisher, WHUR, or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Delegate Ayers, thank you so much for joining the conversation.
I'm looking forward to it.
Talk to me a little bit about the significance in your mind of yesterday, considering that Breonna's Law and the principles upon which it was based happened in Kentucky. It didn't happen in Virginia. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, thank you so much for the invitation to come on to the show. And relative to the significance, you know, I think a lot of people forget about the fact that this practice used by law enforcement has been around for many decades, going back to the Nixon administration. And when this practice began, it was even controversial then, which, I mean, they went through, allowed for this practice to go on. They took it away because of the harm that it was causing in largely black and brown communities. But as the war on drugs went on, they were allowed to resume with the practice. And so although the conversation resurfaced due to the tragic loss of Breonna Taylor in Kentucky, this has long been a controversial practice, both in Kentucky, both in Virginia, and throughout our country. And so the fact that after many decades and this tragic loss, we were finally able to get rid of a practice that really has traumatized a number of people, has led to death in other instances, both of law enforcement and those they had come in contact with. This is really a systemic change to policing practices that really should have never been allowed to continue to begin with.
Was this ever an issue in the Commonwealth, or was this push, along with so many of the other reforms, an attempt to make sure that it didn't happen?
So what was fascinating is in the Commonwealth, as well as in other states, there is very little data collected and tracked on the use of no-knock search warrants and other search warrants, quite frankly, for that matter. The rate in which they are used, the rate in which they're used in specific types of communities, there's just very little data. And so as we began to look at the code of Virginia, we realized our code was actually silent on its use. There was no prescriptive language at all to guide law enforcement with using this particular tactic. And so we did include this as part of a much larger reform towards policing and criminal justice reform generally as a result of prevention, trying to make sure that since we know that this is a practice that has been shown to cause harm, let's make sure that this is not something that occurs in the Commonwealth of Virginia.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking about a sweeping police reform in the Commonwealth of Virginia. Yesterday, Governor Ralph Northam signed Breonna's Law, the no-knock warrant law, of course, named after Breonna Taylor, who was shot to death by Louisville, Kentucky police back in March. My guest is Virginia State Delegate Latrice Aird. And lines are open. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. As I mentioned in the beginning of the program, Delegate Aird, this was just one of many layers of police reform for the Commonwealth. To put it frankly, the legislative body got a lot of stuff done in a short period of time. A laundry list of things. Can you kind of give us the police reform 101 on what exactly was in the many legislative packages that were passed?
Well, I will tell you, you are right in saying that it was a laundry list, because there were a number of bills. And actually, you know, before I get into some of the most desired bills that we were able to successfully pass, I just have to really commend the working relationship between advocates and legislators. You know, I often say that there is a distinct role for both entities, but working together to actually bring about the change, it is just an absolute necessity. And because of the outpour and the outcry that we saw, even here in the Commonwealth prior to the special session being called, it was easy for legislators to pick up the issues that needed to be addressed during the special session, because so many advocates were very clear about systemic reforms that we could make. And so there was just a tremendous partnership that took place. And I will start with this bill that was carried by a legislator in Richmond that would mandate that an officer on duty must intervene to stop the use of force by another officer. You know, as we all observe the just gut-wrenching video of George Floyd, in that video, you saw other law enforcement officers that were present and did not stop what was occurring. And so one of the very first bills that we rallied around was basically mandating that if you are a law enforcement officer and you observe your colleague applying excessive force, that you have a duty to intervene, which is, you know, another measure of being proactive, because this is just something that should have never happened. And it almost seems as though unimaginable that we would have to mandate this, but that is just the place in which we are in. And so that was a major bill that we were able to also get passed.
If I may, I want to drill down on that just a little bit. Because, okay, of course, we know that the killing of George Floyd was just horrific on its face, just horrible. And yet, for me, probably for yourself, and for so many Americans who saw that video, there had to be, you know, this kind of unifying cry for, you know, why doesn't someone stop this while it's happening? Because that's what that law is about. And it is unfortunate, dare I say, you know, an absolute shame that, in making an arrest, and particularly when you have a helpless suspect, that you have to legislate doing the right thing for those who are supposed to protect and serve.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Were you surprised that there needed to be that kind of law? We talked about no knock being Breonna's law, but this could be called the what the heck law. I mean, you know, I say that tongue in cheek, but I mean that. What the heck, man? You know,
it was an emotionally charged concept to have to talk through. It was emotionally charged to have to discuss the bill in committee and on the floor, and it became further emotionally charged to think about those individuals. Because everyone was not in lockstep, let's be clear about that, you know, throughout the governing process. And you had some law enforcement, you had some members of the other side of the aisle that thought it was not the General Assembly's place to put this type of law on the books. And so for you and I, this seems basic.
Yeah.
You see an officer doing wrong, you stand by. You shouldn't even be allowed to keep your job if you are standing by and watching that happen. But let's be clear, the argument was made that, no, this goes too far. We should leave it up to law enforcement to decide. And so, you know, for us, it just seems like a basic measure. And it's shocking that we have arrived at such a place where this is necessary. But if we want to protect lives and if we want to ensure that we do not allow a perpetual cycle to continue, no, we're going to put these policies in place as long as we have to, because it clearly is not just basic principle and common sense anymore. And it leads me into, you know, another major bill that we were able to pass, which was carried by my colleague in Newport News, Delegate Price, which allows for the strengthening of assessments prior to law enforcement being hired. And this gets at not allowing officers to sort of hop around from department to department. If you have had cases of excessive force in the past, if you have significant disciplinary action on your record, that law that we passed will now allow a greater level of scrutiny to occur. Also something that seems, you know, like common sense, but is a real thing that is happening. An officer getting disciplined at one place and then hopping around to the next department without an appropriate level of disclosure being required and or scrutiny occurring, and allowing them to continue bad behavior and bad practices wherever they go.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking about the sweeping police reform that was passed by Virginia lawmakers earlier this year during a special session, specifically Breonna's Law, named after Breonna Taylor, who was killed by Louisville, Kentucky police back in March. Let's go to the phone lines. Hunt, calling from Springfield, Virginia. Hunt, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
First of all, good evening to everyone. I just want to say my condolences to Breonna and her fiance's families, both families, and all the lawmakers. Thank you and God bless you. Very quick turnaround, as you said. However, Virginia has a lot of work. I just want to say one thing about the court system. You being a black person, a black female, you could be in the right, and you're overlooked, you're talked down to. So you're just ignored in the courts here in Fairfax. And so for this bill, the lawmakers to turn this around, seems like with no problem, is a blessing. So thank you all.
Hunt, thank you so much. Anything you want to share, Delegate Aird?
I want to say that first and foremost, you know, I apologize about any experience that she has had. It sounds as though she has had an adverse experience, you know, in Fairfield, in our courts, in Fairfax, I'm sorry, in our courts there. And I would agree with her. Virginia absolutely has a long way to go. You know, we have had 400 years of a very racially charged history, and we are trying to tear down the negative components of that history bit by bit. And some of what we were able to do during the special session is allowing us to just scratch the surface of doing that work. But what I can know, what I can assure Hunt of, is that there will be more work to be done during the 2021 session. And we are absolutely listening and paying attention to those needs, and we'll continue to respond. But I think what is important to also note is, while it may appear as though we got this done swiftly and easily, it was a battle every step of the way. You know, we went into session in August, and we stayed in special session for 83 days. And the reason why it was so long, and mind you, that is longer than our regular session in the winter, and that is longer than the short session we are about to have because it's an odd year. But it took that time because these were very difficult conversations, and everyone, and I don't want to make it political, but even Democrats were not with us every step of the way. And so it is really important for people to continue to advocate and to be in direct contact with their representatives, because you get the final product in the end and it's done, but it's an absolute collaborative battle that we are fighting here to get these things done.
We are talking to Virginia State Delegate LaCherise Aird. We're talking about police reform in the Commonwealth, sweeping laws passed earlier this year. Breonna's Law, signed by the governor just yesterday. But what does police reform in the Commonwealth really look like, and what does it mean? We are still taking your phone calls, as always, up until 8 o'clock at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM, Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. The original Quiet Storm starts with John Mons on WHUR in just a few seconds. We'll be back in a bit. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM, Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We're talking about Breonna's Law, the police reform measure signed into law in Virginia yesterday. My guest is Virginia Delegate LaCherise Aird. We're talking about police reform in the Commonwealth. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Delegate Aird, one of the things that concerns me as we kind of look at the many laws that were passed, there is the issue of money. For example, it's one thing to pass legislation that says police officers have to do the right thing when they see, you know, one of their fellow officers doing the wrong thing. That costs no money. But when you're talking about more than $6 million for police body cams and other issues, is there a concern about moving money around because of the COVID-19 pandemic and the public health crisis? Is it possible that that some of these things may not happen because of the public health emergency that we are all in right now?
And it is an absolute fact. You know, for every piece of legislation that we put in, we get called what's called a fiscal impact statement. And that lets you know exactly how much is going to cost the Commonwealth and or possibly a local government to implement your bill. And we saw a lot of that during this past session relative to how much some of these things would cost a local law enforcement agency or our state police. And we were fortunate that as a legislature, we really wanted to prioritize these reforms, and if that meant taking a look at our budget and trying to find the money or reprioritizing what was already in place, we did some of that. But obviously, there were some measures that were put on hold until we are in better economic circumstances. And so some of what you'll see in the 2021 legislative session is an attempt for members to try and do some of that, to determine, are we in a place of economic stability, even though the pandemic is still going on, with the support that we have, you know, received from the federal government? Has that been enough? You know, trying to answer those types of questions is what we'll be doing in 2021 to also determine, can we go further with policing reforms and can we actually afford it?
Mm-hmm. Talk to me a little bit about this so-called Driving While Black law, the stopping, for example, of vehicles on the road under
Yes.
pretext of racially motivated stops.
Yeah, so House Bill 5058, carried by Delegate Hope, that would actually, it is directly what you're talking about, eliminating, you know, certain vehicle equipment offenses, as well as even the odor of marijuana from being allowable as a pretext to stop to be searched by law enforcement. So, you know, before you could get pulled over, and if you had that brake light that, you know, wasn't properly illuminated, or if you appear to, you know, have a defective license plate or anything on your vehicle that a law enforcement officer could say might appear to be unsafe, or your vehicle was excessively loud. Like, all of those things have historically been known to adversely impact Black people. And what's fascinating is I was actually really proud of the delegate who carried this legislation, because he admitted that prior to the conversation around policing reforms and criminal justice reforms, he was completely unaware of this. And so this is a white man who was open enough to saying, the moment I realized that this was a thing, I wanted to carry this legislation, because it's not right that I have never had this happen to me, but I have asked this question of every, you know, Black individual that I've come in contact with. And this is a common practice, and it is a norm that should have never become a norm. And so this legislation will make it so that that is no longer the case. You know, law enforcement would have to have a legitimate primary offense to be stopping you for, outside of these pretextual stops that were occurring far too often.
One of the other things, another, you know, what the heck law, sexual relations between law enforcement and people in their custody. So in Virginia, that was.
I'm almost embarrassed to admit that the code was silent on this.
I mean, that and the reason, you know, and so in the reason I am incredulous about that is because in Maryland, in the past couple of years, there have been more than a handful of cases where police officers have been suspended and then prosecuted for soliciting sex from people in their custody, more specifically women that they pulled over. And getting into the legal jargon, yes, once you pull over, that person is technically, I guess, in custody. And so and so at that, and even if not under arrest. And so I just find it fascinating that Virginia is playing catch up, or has played catch up, with something that seems to be common sense.
And I think it's important to note, so when this bill first came before me, I was also surprised that, so our code listed everyone else, you know, in a local correctional facility, in a regional jail, you know, Department of Corrections, employees or volunteers, but there was no law enforcement. Probably your first point of contact before you even get to those places. And so I'm really proud that what seems like another obvious measure has now been expanded to include law enforcement officers. And then more specifically, the bill drills down to make sure it identifies juveniles that have been detained or arrested specifically, because not just proactively, but if I recall correct, there had been at least some accusations that this was happening.
You know, yesterday, the governor made a point about saying these were not anti-police laws. He was speaking, obviously, specifically of the Breonna Taylor law, but he also spoke more expansively about the many laws that were passed. Do you have, obviously, we know that, you know, often with some kind of police reform, that, you know, the rank and file and the police unions give pushback. But do you have support from from police officers' leadership for these kinds of things?
So I actually have to start back with the no-knock search warrant legislation, because I had significant support, and I have to mention this police department particularly, but the police chief in Chesterfield. I learned through this process that actually that police department here in Virginia in Chesterfield County has not used the practice of no-knock search warrant for many decades. And he stated something profound to me in describing why, in that they believe entirely from a principled position that individuals should be able to choose how they are going to engage with law enforcement, and that should they arrive at their property with a search warrant, they want the people inside to know if you respond, negatively, law enforcement will act one way to that behavior. But if you decide to comply and you have chosen to respond in such a way that's perceived positively or normally or within your rights, you know, then law enforcement will respond to that. But ultimately, it should be those individuals that they are encountering who has the final choice of how they decide to involve and engage with law enforcement. And so throughout the process of that legislation, they were advocates, the police chief, and they weighed in and offered direct feedback on how to make sure the law or this approach that we were taking would be sound. And now what I will say is, while there was significant pushback generally from the law enforcement community for a number of these policies, you know, I think the balance comes with them weighing in to say, if this is going to go forward, here are our recommendations on how to make sure this policy does not have unintended consequences. And so there was much collaboration and working through a number of measures. Now, the downside to that, in my opinion, is that you also had some bills that in the end were not as strong as they were intended to be when they were first introduced. And you ended up with, for lack of a better reference, sort of watered down bills. I'll give you the example of the legislation to ban the use of neck restraints. When that legislation was introduced, it was introduced as a full outright ban. Another bill in response to what occurred, what happened in the tragic event of George Floyd. But in the end, that bill passed, but with the exception that only if it's, you know, necessary to protect the officer or another person. And so that was a bill that started out in one place and went in another because of the pushback from law enforcement. And so it is dependent on the piece of legislation, bill by bill, and oftentimes that pushback, it requires a bit of political courage to be able to have members to overcome that and support any stronger forms of some of these policies. And so that's some of what I mean when I say, yes, we end up with a product in the end, but it is certainly a bit of a battle every step of the way.
I'm sure you are familiar with the investigative story from the Virginian pilot about what was happening in Portsmouth.
Yeah.
And it's a long piece, but it brings about, you know, a lot of questions about an old saying, which is you cannot legislate prejudice. And, you know, the article reports that, you know, white officers ignoring requests for black for backup for black officers at times, you know, officers who were, you know, promoted, even though they had railed against, you know, unarmed, a black teenager specifically. And there's just a laundry list of things that, at least, you know, to any well-thinking person, that would be described as prejudice at the least and racist at the most. What piece of legislation, if any, can address these kinds of situations that are likely not just particular to Portsmouth?
Yes, I think that in my experience and over time, I have heard that this culture exists in law enforcement, generally speaking. So the light was really shed on what was happening in Portsmouth, but this is not an uncommon, these are not uncommon behaviors in my experience. I think there are actually two bills that will begin, and it will take some time before this actually, I think, is felt in actual departments. But there was legislation, House Bill 5108 in 2009. They would do two things. First, you would be able to diversify the Department of Criminal Justice Services Committee on Training. Now, this is critical because when you talk about what officers learn at the very foundational level, what allows certain behaviors to be allowed and not, and you talk about real systemic change. If we want to change why an officer is sitting on the sidelines observing poor behavior, if we want to change how they're interacting with an individual when they do stop them, it goes back to their very basic training. And so diversifying the committee on training will allow a broader group of people, and not just diversity in the race sense, but diversity in the mental health professionals, diversity in the overall social well-being of individuals by industry, to be represented in that on that committee, so that they can have eyes and say, hey, you know, I know this might be sound criminal justice practice or law enforcement practice, but look at it from this angle. If you are engaging with someone who's having a mental health crisis, for example, and really allow that training on cultural bodies, all of these things to be assessed from a greater, more diversified group of people, so that you can get at trying to eliminate some of that racial behavior and, quite frankly, other severely poor practices that we are seeing in the worst of police misconduct issues. And secondly, the House Bill 5109, which would enhance training by criminal justice academies, that's the same thing, getting back to at the very root and at the core of where they are receiving their training, so that before they're even out in the public as officers, we can permeate those areas that they are learning how to actually do this job.
I want to talk to you a little bit about sheriff's departments. We've been using the term police, but certainly any law passed in the Commonwealth would apply to all law enforcement. And yet, as you know, and some of our listeners who are above the Mason-Dixon line may not know, sheriffs are constitutionally elected officers. They are often the most powerful elected official in any county in this nation. And we have seen, for example, in Florida and California, sheriffs who've declined to enforce executive orders regarding masks. How would Virginia deal with sheriffs who decide that they don't want to follow some of these laws that have passed that would reform their departments?
Well, I would say that this is a really tricky one, because in addition to the issue of the mask wearing in Virginia, largely through many of our counties, you have seen them take these Second Amendment sanctuary locality declarations, which, you know, deems them free of any of the gun laws that have been passed during the 2020 session. And so that is the kind of environment you're talking about in Virginia. And so specifically when it comes to their willingness to adhere to these bills that have been passed that will become law in March, you know, I have a hard time believing that sheriffs as elected officials will break the law. I know that it is one thing to not agree with the mask wearing, which unfortunately we have not made a mandate here as strongly as we can in the Commonwealth. I mean, it should be common sense at this point. It, you know, like what you say, what the heck? Mm-hmm. And I know that they have passed some of these ceremonial Second Amendment sanctuary city resolutions. But at the end of the day, they have an obligation to uphold the law. And so I want to believe that when it comes down to that, that that is what will occur. But look, sheriff's officers that participate in misconduct are no different than law enforcement that participates in misconduct. And there are just bad apples. And we have seen that happen. What I will say is the benefit of having a sheriff's officer versus a hired police chief is that you can get rid of a sheriff if they are allowing misconduct to run rampant within their department. The citizens have direct say over that person's job and whether they keep it or not every so often when they're up for reelection. I think the bigger problem, though, is, and this is very much cultural, when you think about some of the places where these sheriffs are operating in very rural, and again, not to make it partisan, but Republican communities, some of that behavior is accepted and tolerated. And that is why it has, you know, been allowed to go on. And so I know that we did pass the Civilian Review Committee legislation during this past session as an effort to try and get at some of that misconduct with citizen direct involvement. But overall, we just simply have a long way to go as it pertains to sheriff's department and the direct type of, you know, accountability we have in that regard to them.
But I would challenge you on the piece about elected sheriffs. It is very easy to remove a police chief, just as it is easy to hire one. They are, by and large, you know, at will. If you are a city police chief and you have an elected mayor, a strong mayor, the mayor will fire the chief. If it's a county police chief, a county commissioner or county executive, wherever you happen to be, can fire the chief. But an elected sheriff, the process of recall and all of those other things is considerably more difficult to do. And because, again, who's going to fire the sheriff?
Well, I guess my point is only made because largely in Virginia, many of your localities, particularly your cities, they're not strong mayor systems. Richmond is a strong mayor system, but largely in part, you have systems of strong city managers, ceremonial mayors. And so you don't always have this process where these police chiefs are removed. And so that's where I'm coming from. But I certainly understand what you are saying. But I do believe that sheriffs are also political creatures. And when there is an uproar about certain misconducts and behaviors, there is fear of not being elected. And so that is just the perspective that I have. But you certainly make a great point.
What's your opinion about the phrase defund the police?
You know, I think that the people who have made defund the police popular mean one thing and are saying another. I think there is a lot of confusion around what it means in actual practice to say defund the police, and that people mean a variety of things when the phrase is generally tossed around. I believe that there has become an emotional, another emotionally charged reaction when you hear, and I should also add political reaction, when you hear the phrase. And quite frankly, we are not having a conversation around actually what is intended when the phrase is used.
Because, and I ask this specifically because of what you said, you know, as a political animal, an elected official, yes, you may have, you know, movements like, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement that may shout defund the police. And yet, when you begin to get down into the weeds of the discussion, sometimes the, as a practical matter, as a matter of public safety, as a matter of community policing and community involvement and connecting with the community, no one seems to want to use reform the police or reimagine
right.
the police. Is it
right.
is it time to have some straight talk about the chant versus the reality so as to get those who would not normally be on board with reforms to come under the same tent?
No, I think that's absolutely right. And that's, I think, one of the challenges of protesting and advocating versus governing, right? So as an advocate that may be taken to the streets and demanding this change, in order to really make those systemic changes, you've got to be willing to be realistic about the process, the logistics, if you will, of what it takes to actually accomplish the goal, which has even led to you crying out this particular phrase. And I think that is a lot of what you have seen happen, not just in the Commonwealth, but throughout the country. Does an assessment need to occur of where dollars are being invested, how law enforcement entities are utilizing the dollars that they are being allocated? Should we be taking a look at what community resources are needed that might lead to greater prevention of individuals coming in contact with law enforcement? Certainly. But now that we are in a position where that phrase has been so mischaracterized and that phrase now means something so politically toxic to groups of people, and governing requires a variety of types of people, yeah, it is time for us to have that conversation, because I do think we mean well. I do think that the individuals who are using the phrase mean well, but how do we actually go about getting it accomplished? And we can't get there if we don't have the conversation of what that phrase actually means.
Final point. You mentioned that the police reform work of the legislature is not done, and you mentioned 2021. What's on your legislative wish list for police reform in 2021?
Well, in 2021, for me, I will be focused deeply on the use of facial recognition databases by use of law enforcement agencies. You know, right here in the Commonwealth, we had a police department in Norfolk that adopted for a period of time, albeit the use of one of these facial recognition databases. And it was widely reported that this database has been known for racial bias. And, you know, it occurred to me that when an investigation occurred about the use of this database, none of the governing body knew, not your council members, not your mayor, not citizens. And to me, I think we need to adopt an approach where your local government should have to approve the use of such a database by your law enforcement agency, because ultimately the people should be able to, number one, have the level of transparency of knowing that this is going to be something used in their community, but then also decide, is this something they want used in their community? And that's just not happening right now. Aside from the database, we know how many problems exist just with the use of facial recognition technology and body cams and generally. And so I believe we have to start to think about how we are going to choose to engage with not just this type of technology, but emerging technologies generally, because the criminal justice system is going in that direction. And if we don't start having that conversation now, by the time it becomes a kitchen table topic, it'll already be too late and be widely used.
I think that's a good place to end this conversation. Virginia State Delegate LaCherise Ayard, thank you so much for spending some time with us and talking about these really critical issues. We will definitely be in touch. We want to find out what's happening in 2021. So thank you so much, and please be safe.
Thank you.
Absolutely. That is the Daily Drum for this Tuesday, December 8th. I'm Harold Fisher. Now, stay tuned for Unheard with Wes Hall. Good night.